Next case is 04-2173, Marlene Campbell versus The Ohio State University Medical Center. Mr. Pierre-Louis.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice and to the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio, may it please the Court, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal in this argument.
Watch your time there.
Your Honors, I am Lloyd Pierre-Louis, and it's my privilege to represent Ms. Marlene Campbell, the appellate in this case. She's seated with me at counsel's table along with her two daughters, Rhonda Frazier and Tanya Montgomery. We're seeking today an order reversing the Franklin County Court of Appeals decision of November 16, 2004, which affirmed the Court of Claims' grant of summary judgment against Ms. Campbell in favor of Ohio State University's Medical Center, which I'll refer to as OSU. More specifically, we're seeking an order from this court stating that claims brought by mental health patients against mental health care organizations to vindicate their rights under the Ohio Patients' Bill of Rights are not subject to the heightened standards of Ohio's identifiable victim statute. The Patient's Bill of Rights is codified at Revised Code Section 5122.29. The identifiable law, identifiable victim law is codified at Section 2305.51 of the Revised Code. We're going to propose three reasons that the court should adopt this proposal before we get into the facts and the analysis of this case. First, the identifiable victim law itself states that RC 2305.51 does not affect civil rights, and it's our contention that as a matter of law, the Patient's Bill of Rights constitutes civil rights under Ohio law. Specifically, the statute 2305.51E specifically states that this statute, this section, shall not affect civil rights under Ohio and federal law. Second, the language of both statutes strongly suggests separate and distinct aims, goals, and objectives of both laws.
Let me stop you there, because you mentioned a section of the statute that I think is very important. E, the one you just, this section does not affect the civil rights. We have two statutes, obviously, that are seem to be in conflict, the earlier, the more general, than the later one. But even within this section of 51, B and E seem to be, is it your argument that E just vitiates or does away with B?
No, Your Honor. My argument is that you can look at these two statutes and read them simultaneously, and they both can apply. I think the 2305.51B is triggered under a separate analysis. And if I could expand on that, Your Honor. The identifiable victim law concerns three categories of prospective liability against mental health care providers: the failure to warn of violent behavior, the failure to predict violent behavior, and the failure to take precautions to protect. That seems to be what the state's argument is focused on, is the failure to take precautions to protect, whereas the Patient's Bill of Rights, 5122.29B2, is very specific in that right. Each patient shall be given reasonable protection from assault and battery.
Counsel, if we were to accept your position that the reasonable protection from assault or battery trumps the other section, when would the other section ever apply? Can you give me an example of when the other section would ever be applicable?
The statute, House Bill 71, I believe, has in the as part of its legislative intent, it says it's specifically to supersede paragraphs 2, 3, and 4 of the syllabus in the Estates of Morgan case. In that case, paragraphs 2, 3, and 4 specify the outpatient setting. It had no bearing whatsoever on the inpatient setting.
So is your position that this section that on predictability only applies if it's an outpatient?
I'm arguing
isn't in the statute, so I'm asking, is that the only time, in your opinion, it applies?
No, but I'm simply suggesting to the court that the patient's Bill of Rights was not trumped. Once the patient voluntarily or involuntarily is committed to the hospital, the issue becomes, what rights does that patient have?
Okay, then to my question. When can you give me any scenario where you could apply that exemption or that protection for the hospital?
The Estates of Morgan case, the facts that were within that case itself, where you have an outpatient setting, where the patient was medicated for some time, maybe medication was improperly given, but the patient goes out, is released into the public, and assaults another individual who's not a patient within the hospital itself.
So again, your position is that it can only apply to outpatient settings, but once a person is in a hospital setting, the section reasonable protection trumps any prior knowledge.
No, Your Honor, that's not necessarily as well, because the patient's Bill of Rights only applies to patients. It's limited to those individuals who have been voluntarily committed or involuntarily committed and are subjecting themselves to treatment from the hospital. Arguably, under the statute, a visitor could be attacked by another patient or by a patient, and I think we'd go through the same analysis to determine if the identifiable victim law was triggered.
So we basically have to restrict our reading of the section requiring prior notice and predictability or so. We have to pretty much restrict that to anyone that is not a patient. So basically, you are saying that the Bill of Rights trumps a patient right to protection, and that the exemption will not apply to a patient in setting.
I think so, but I think if I can just state it this way, once a patient is committed voluntarily or involuntarily, the identifiable victim statute does not trump any of the rights that are codified within the patient's Bill of Rights.
Okay, then if you take that position, then how do you get around the argument that they still have their civil rights, but civil rights can be defined by statute as to what is allowed for recovery and what is not? How do you get around that argument as a definition of what that civil right becomes?
I'm not understanding the question. The civil right...
The fact that they have a civil right to sue is not unfettered. There are all sorts of limitations in many, many statutes on who you can sue and when you can sue and time limitations and defenses available. How do you get around the argument that civil right creates in and of itself nothing? You then have to look to other statutes and other causes of action to create what is exactly that right.
Sure. I don't think that is in conflict. There's no question that the right to sue still exists. The issue is, what is the right that can be vindicated under the statute? The right to sue is not affected if the plaintiff or the victim still has the ability to file a lawsuit. But if you change the standard that's applicable, if you heighten the standard for what is reasonable under the circumstances, you have affected a civil right. Not the right to sue, but the civil right, which is codified in 5122.29b2. The right is actually for respect and dignity. It's not necessarily just to sue. The civil right is, the term is defined, I believe, in 5122.301. It's incorporated by reference in the identifiable victim law. The issue is that civil rights statute indicates it's without limitation. So although it lists your civil rights as being the right to marry, the right to sue, the right to vote, it also indicates without limitation. And what's contained within that phrase without limitation? We've got to look to Ohio case law. And Ohio case law, although the Supreme Court hasn't necessarily provided a definition of a civil right, other case law, which is cited within the reply brief, suggests certain criteria for what civil rights are. There are rights that can be vindicated by a civil action. There are rights that are, they're not necessarily natural rights, which you get by virtue of being born, but they are rights that can be protected by the statute, rights that attach to each citizen within a state, and that are created by statute.
Well, isn't the problem here that, I mean, the reason the case is here is because 29, the right at all times to be treated with consideration and respect for his privacy and dignity, and then and also persons committed voluntarily and involuntarily should be given reasonable protection. We have that statute, the general statute, which seems to give, that's the civil right, isn't it? That's the right that a person has, a mental patient has, if they're in an institution. And then the General Assembly has given us this other statute, which seems to conflict with that, the very specific statute, which says, well, yeah, we give you these civil rights to be treated, you know, with dignity and protected, but the state is immune from suit under these certain circumstances, which seem to be in conflict with the general statute. Isn't that the issue here? And we have to decide which statute applies.
I submit to the court there's only one statute that can apply to this particular situation. In this particular circumstance, the Bill of Rights has to apply. The General Assembly made an attempt in House Bill 71 to coordinate two statutes, and that now conceivably could conflict with the Bill of Rights. It's not just the Identifiable Victims Law, but also the state highlighted Code Section 5122.34, subsection B. And here we have three standards. Patient's Bill of Rights says each patient shall be reasonably protected from assault and battery. 2305.51B says that you can only prevail if they fail to take precautions to provide protection. And then 5122.34B says if you there's no liability for attempting to provide protection. We've got three different sets of language that the General Assembly has given us to interpret. It is our belief that this court shouldn't substitute an expansive interpretation for shoddy draftsmanship on the count of the legislature.
What do we do with the principles that we generally apply, and that is if a statute is later adopted and it's more specific than the general statute, that we apply the later adopted statute because we assume that the General Assembly knows what the previous statute says, and when they adopt the later statute, they're writing law in the context of the earlier statute. What's the exception here we should apply?
I don't believe there's an exception. I don't even believe that we have to get that far. I think we simply apply the text of the statutes that have been given to us and which statute applies to this set of circumstances. Hmm. Was there an allegation of a failure to take precautions? I'm sorry, a failure of a failure to take precautions to provide protection. We're not suggesting that there was a failure to take precautions. We never even made an allegation about proper precautions. We don't care about the precautions. Was there a failure in the attempt to protect? We don't believe that's even an issue. There was no attempt made in this case, and we've never even alleged that there was a failure of the attempt to protect. The only failure here was that there was no protection whatsoever. And the statute, the only statute that applies in this case says she shall be given reasonable protection from battery and assault, which is a crime. There's no flexibility there. That's the only statute that is on point. That's the only statute that can conceivably apply to this set of facts.
So, counsel, you're saying when the victim is a patient, you stop the analysis with the patient's Bill of Rights, and it doesn't matter who the tortfeasor was under those circumstances, if the failure to protect the integrity or the rights or afford protection for a patient victim, you don't look at any other statute.
Our argument, you don't look at the other statutes if they don't apply.
Well, they don't apply because you're stating that when the victim is a patient, the only statute that applies is the patient's Bill of Rights. And the immunity statutes or any other statute, there is no statute that would limit the patient's Bill of Rights. That's what you're saying.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm arguing that the patient's Bill of Rights always applies.
Only when the victim is a patient.
When the victim is a patient, absolutely.
Right, that's no matter who the tortfeasor.
No, the patient's Bill of Rights only applies to patients who are within a mental health care organization.
I understand that.
But the issue here is you've got the patient's Bill of Rights, which always applies. Now, how do we take ourselves out and to trigger the identified victim law? The only way to trigger the application of that particular statute is if you are alleging that there's either a failure to predict certain conduct, violent behavior, if there's a failure to warn of violent behavior, or if there's a failure to take precautions to protect violent behavior. In this case, there is no allegation that there is a failure to take precaution to protect. I'm merely reciting verbatim from the statute itself. We should only apply the statute. If we're not dealing with a failure to predict case, a failure to warn case, or failure to take precaution to protect case, then 2305.51 does not apply. Then the next step is to go to 5122.334B. And in that case, in that statute says there must be the state would be immune if there's a failure to attempt to protect. In this case, we are not alleging, and nor have we ever alleged, that there was a failure to attempt to protect. That defaults into the only statute remaining, the Bill of Rights. And the plain text of the statute says, shall be given reasonable protection from assault and battery. And that's under the auspices of the right to dignity.
Your Honor, my
light is up.
Thank you, Mr. Pierre-Louis. Mr. Kearney.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The facts here are undeniably tragic, but Ms. Campbell nevertheless cannot hold Ohio State's Medical Center liable for at least three reasons. That her claim does fall under the text of 2305.51, the identifiable victim law. That there's no persuasive reason why a later in time, more specific statute should be trumped by an earlier, more general statute. And finally, even if she could somehow switch the legal standard over to her preferred standard, based on the summary judgment grant below and the finding that there was only one expert who testified that the reasonable standard of care was met, this would be a summary judgment case anyway. Under any standard, she wouldn't get to trial. But first, I want to address this claim that this doesn't fall under the statute under 2305 on its own terms, because, as counsel says, they're trying to distinguish from a failure to protect from a failure to take precautions to protect. I'm not sure from a dictionary definition what the difference between protection and precaution to take protection is, but even if there were such a way to slice the dictionary definition, I point to the complaint, paragraph 7, that says, physicians and or psychiatric professionals on duty did not take proper medical precautions in connection with their treatment, et cetera. So the phrase did not take proper medical precautions, which I believe counsel said has never been alleged in this case, is in paragraph 7 of the amended complaint. Further, that same complaint later in the violation of patient's Bill of Rights in count 5 in paragraph 34 states it as defendant OSU hospital negligently failed to provide plaintiff with reasonable protection. So if the idea of failure to provide or failure to take precaution is somehow different from just the noun reasonable protection, their own complaint puts them within the four corners of 2305.51. Moreover, any argument that would get you out of this isn't a protection claim, this is somehow just a restraining the other patient claim, not a protect me claim. If that were true, that would also take you right out of 5122 itself, because 5122 talks about protection. It doesn't talk about restraint of others or any such theory. So this falls under 2305.51. Then the question is there a reason we should say, even if it textually falls under both statutes, that this one trumps or that one trumps? As Chief Justice Moyer noted, the 2305.51 is later in time. The appeals court went just on that, said even if we couldn't tell which is more specific, this one is later in time. On top of that,
what's the value of 0.29 then? The legislature states all these rights of patients, but then in 51, it sort of takes them away, it seems.
Well, Your Honor, 5122.29 does state more things than just protection. Remember that the backdrop is, unfortunately, in America, we often had decades of warehousing patients instead of treating them with dignity and respect. So some of these things, even if they're just statements of intent, are very important in saying you have the right to receive phone calls, to have visitors, to even keep your appearance the way you like, instead of everyone having their hair cut off in some, you know, military fashion. The idea here is let's tell hospitals that you have to treat patients with dignity and respect.
Well, in B2, a person who's committed a voluntary manslaughter shall be given reasonable protection from assault or battery by any other person. And then 51 says, well, yes, but.
Well, Your Honor, to the extent, there are two ways of looking at what the effect of 2305-51 is. One is to say, well, actually, they maybe can be harmonized, and 2305-51 is simply defining what's reasonable. We think it's reasonable when you have a concrete threat to react to it. We don't think it's reasonable when there's no threat to over-restrain people when you're doing this tricky balancing act of maintaining the maximum dignity for patients. So one way is to say this is defining reasonableness. The other way, if you do see it as trumping reasonableness, is that it would still apply, the 5122.29 would still apply if, for example, you're talking about protection from, you know, staff who sometimes lose their temper. Unfortunately, this is a field that in decades past, we think there's been great strides in recent decades, but was marked with sometimes problems with staff, problems with visitors, problems. So the fact that these intersect when you have the patient-on-patient situation doesn't mean that either one is ever totally trumped. They only intersect when you have a patient-on-patient setting. 2305-51, of course, applies in all sorts of outpatient settings as well as inpatient settings. And meanwhile, 5122 is supposed to protect a plaintiff potential victim against all comers. The only difference is when you fall under both categories, you have to meet the specific standards of 2305-51. I also want to note the importance of 5122-34.
Mr. Carney, I'm wondering, I don't think I've asked you this before, I've asked others. Is the state constitutionally immune from suit?
No, Your Honor. This case, unlike many other state cases we have here, does not involve the state status as the state at all. OSU happens to be running a hospital, a mental hospital here, but the standard in 2305 is about any mental health professional organization. So Case Western's, North Coast Behavioral, any private hospital in the state, all private doctors, the General Assembly recognized,
but
face this
difficulty. But this is
difficult.
A state suit.
This happens to be a state suit, all but right. We're not claiming any form of immunity. We're not right. Claiming to be sued by any difference from how private hospitals
doesn't
would be sued.
Doesn't 2305-51 interfere with the right to a remedy?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. But first, no claim has ever been made here. The right to remedy, as far as I've seen, has never been mentioned in any breath, in any brief in this case below or in this court. So that claim wouldn't be made. If someone were to make that someday, that would be different. But we don't believe it does, because it does provide a remedy. I mean, all it says is we're choosing this path that in the states of Morgan, the court came down 4-3 one way, could have come down 4-3 the other way, and the legislature said, we like this way rather than that way. That's in derogation of the common law, as this court said in Johnson v. BP Chemicals.
But
the legislature.
But 51 is being used to say somebody can beat you up severely. The allegation is that the caregivers here knew of the propensity of this other patient to be harmful to others and did not protect this patient from it. Now, there's still a lot to be proven, but you're using the statute just to take away a remedy altogether, are you not?
Well, it's not taking away. It's defining the contours of when it applies. For example, unfortunately.
Well, no, that's an.
Tragedies happen. If someone attacks me as I wait for the bus at the bus stop, I might not be able to sue the bus station because they weren't there. They didn't know what was happening. Here,
it's a matter of control.
It's a matter of how much control, how much knowledge, and what the legislature was balancing, as both sides recognized in the Estates of Morgan case, was that there's a tricky balancing of, there's an easy way to avoid liability, and that's to take virtually everyone who says, I'm depressed, I need help, and just start locking everyone up under the most restrictive circumstances. We don't want to do that. And here, in this case, I note that even if there were a concern about other cases and right to remedy, which hasn't been raised here, that here, the only expert to testify, Dr. Nofsinger for Ohio State, said they met the reasonable standard of care. They put the other patient on medication. This is a medication most doctors would use, a common one. Then they changed medication as things happen. This tragedy occurred. Sometimes things happen in 15 seconds. Not everything is preventable, unfortunately. And here, they did everything that normal doctors prudently would do. And that's why we suggest that even if the court somehow were to find against us on our proposition of law, summary judgment would still be upheld because the 10th District upheld an ordinary medical negligence grant of summary judgment on this medical negligence count, saying under this court's Bruni case from 1976 that you have to have an expert when you're talking about failure to follow a standard of care. On one side, there's no expert. On another side, there's an unrebutted expert. This would be a summary judgment case under any standard.
Counsel, neither statute limits the patient's right to sue the person that committed the assault or battery, does it?
That's true, Your Honor. So there's obviously always a suit against the assailant.
It's only covering third parties or other parties who have some, perhaps some responsibility toward him, but it's not, it doesn't in any way limit any remedy against the actual person committing assault.
Exactly. And also, in regard to third party liability, I do want to amend my answer to Justice Pfeiffer when I said this is no different for being the state. In terms of any immunity claim, it's no different. But there is one difference. Here, because the state under 9.86 and the Court of Claims Act, the state covers all liability and individual employees are immune. But the standard you adopt today for 5122 and 2305 will apply to private hospitals. And in private hospitals, the approach is usually not just to sue the assailant, but on the third party part of it, to sue both the individual doctors and nurses and the institution or entity. And so these individual doctors and nurses, as Justice Stratton's dissent noted in Estates of Morgan and Justice Resnick's majority opinion noted as well, that, you know, there are people making really hard decisions every day here. This is a field a lot of people are not eager to go in or to stay in for many years, and another burden of liability on them is something the legislature wanted to relieve, to say, when you make a good faith judgment.
I would like you to address Section E of 2305.51. What do you think was the intent of the legislature when they put that in?
Well, in 2305.51, I think the legislature was trying to do several layers of things. First, to define what the when a duty of care even attaches.
I just want you to address Section E. This section does not affect the civil rights of a mental health client or patient under Ohio or federal law.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think in that section, I think they were trying to do a couple of things. One, I think the civil rights they were addressing there, since 2305 is all about a mental patient as tortfeasor, not as victim, as in 5122, I think the reason they were saying this should not affect civil rights is because they didn't want someone to go overzealously trying to lock up everybody, that the patient who might be a threat but might not be a threat still has a civil right to go through a commitment process, to go through a competency hearing before they're involuntarily detained in a mental hospital. So when they were saying we don't want to affect civil rights of mental patients, they were talking about the patients as potential tortfeasors. I don't think they were talking about as victims there, although as a technical matter, of course, it would cover everyone.
Health client or patient. Right. Even put those words in.
I think client or patient does cover both client. I think in our nomenclature today, some people use the word client to mean everyone, but I think there's a sense sometimes of using, when you don't use the prefix inpatient and outpatient, to use patient to mean a patient in a hospital and a client to mean someone who comes on a, you know, weekly basis for treatment as an outpatient or that sort of thing. I think the client or patient would cover both of those concepts, inpatient or outpatient. And clearly, 2305.51 was considering not only the inpatient setting, but the very common setting of someone who is an inpatient who's maybe about to be an outpatient. The question whether to release someone, which was much at issue in, you know, Tarasoff, many of the Tarasoff cases around the country from California and all the other states, where they talk about inpatients becoming outpatients, or about outpatients who just come in every week and raise a concern. I also want to note that in 5122.34, that really clinches it. Aside from the fact that 2305.51 is later in time and is more specific, even if one were to look at the way the 10th District did and say both are equally specific, 230551 applies because in 512234, the legislature went in and said, as they were passing 2305, that's what's really clear about it. They passed 2305, and in the very same act, they go into 5122. They go into that chapter and they say, except as otherwise provided in 2305.51 of the revised code, no person shall be liable for any harm, et cetera, for failing to otherwise attempt to protect such other person from harm. So they're in 5122. They're in the context of the same chapter that includes the statements in 5122.29, and they say, except as provided over in 2305.51, no one's liable. So they're basically saying, if you want to know what the standard of liability is, here's a cross-reference. Go see 2305. There's no way to overcome that unless, as plaintiffs suggested, this allegation is somehow not about failing to protect from harm by such client. But as I quote it from the complaint, this is about failure to protect. If it weren't about failure to protect, it wouldn't be a claim at all. We wouldn't be here.
Well, wouldn't that part of the statute get even more dangerously into an effort to deny a remedy, because as you say, this applies both public and private?
Well, it's not denying a remedy in the sense that it says that, if you have a clear threat, you can sue. If you don't have a clear threat, you don't. But that's no different from what the legislature all the time does when it creates an employment discrimination law and says, if you show direct discrimination, you get to sue. If someone makes other types of decisions, you don't. Some things are suable on, some things aren't. But again, I do note that any constitutional arguments based on right to remedy certainly aren't before the court today, have never been raised, were not part of the grant of jurisdiction by this court, and would be for another day and another year, if at all, although we dispute them even then. But again, here, there's no way to take this out of the text, and that's based on not only the facts here, but the facts of the complaint. And under any standard, this would be a case where summary judgment would be granted merely because of the difference between the expert on one side and a complete absence of any expert testimony that the standard of care was not reasonably met here. For those reasons, we ask that you affirm the decision below.
Thank you, Mr. Carney. Mr. Pierre-Louis, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. The court will recall that the Court of Claims made a decision based on one count in the complaint, and the appellant never had the opportunity to brief issues such as the constitutionality. There was a summary judgment motion based on a count that was prior to the amended complaint. The entire case was disposed of on summary judgment, eliminating the appellant's opportunity to raise the constitutional arguments, bring them to the Court of Appeals, and potentially bring them to this court. The other issue is that the state omits that the hospital gave this patient the wrong medicine. They gave this they knew this patient had beaten up another client or another patient the day before, that she ultimately knocked my client's eye out. If the court accepts the proposition of law offered by the state, what we're saying is the victim here the victim's right under the patient's Bill of Rights is subject to the attacker's prior proclamation of his or her intent to assault the patient. And that cannot be the policy of Ohio to eliminate the patient's Bill of Rights in that type of a fashion. Your Honor, we respectfully request that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals with an instruction to the Court of Claims to permit the appellant to go forward with her case on the patient's Bill of Rights. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Pierre-Louis. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.